We just thank you, Father. We thank you for the opportunity to look into your word and lessons from the life of Israel and the establishment of the kingdom here. Just pray that you'd bless our time, open our hearts and our minds to what you have for us. And just pray for all the ministry taking place here tonight, Lord, that as we draw Awana and youth group to a close, that those who haven't come to know you would. In Christ's name, we pray. Amen. Okay. Well, the last time we looked at verses 1 through 14, and we see Saul make his first major blunder, which consequently also costs him his dynasty, okay, an eternal dynasty, one that will ultimately be given to David, a man after God's own heart. Jonathan is the one who is seen to step out in faith first, okay, and now Saul, you know, Saul again bringing up the rear. Saul is tested and he disobeys the Lord, revealing his lack of faith. And really what we see in verses 15 through 23 in chapter 13 and then on into chapter 14, we're going to get hopefully halfway through chapter 14 here today. As we look at those verses, we see the same thing. We see a Jonathan who is stepping out in faith and a Saul who's bringing up the rear, okay? That's the consistent pattern here. For whatever reason, the author is waiting to go into detail on this particular, but it's essentially the same thing that happened when he struck the Philistines at Geba, the garrison there. But this time we're giving greater detail, and the contrast between Jonathan and his father is stark here. Okay, we see a man of faith on the one hand, and we see a man who is faithless on the other. All right, any questions or thoughts before we get into our verses here tonight? Okay, who would like to read verses chapter 13, verses 15 through 18? Yes, Joy. Okay, thank you. So we'll get, well, I guess I could have touched on this. This is where we find ourselves right now, chapters 13 and 14. This is his first disobedience. But where we want to look here, this is Benjamin. You can see Dead Sea is right here. You can barely kind of make out the Mediterranean coast over here. This is over here in this area. You got Gath, Ekron, Gezer, Lachish? Yeah, Lachish. Those are all Philistine. These are Philistine cities over here. This is Philistia. Here's Benjamin right in the middle. There's Gilgal. The Jordan River's running right here. We zoomed in quite a bit, so just so you know where we're looking at here. But this is what we see happening. Things took place in verses 1 through 14 in Gilgal, but now we see that they move more over towards Gibeah, Ramah. Michmash is the center there. That's where the Philistines end up massing their forces. Geba is where Jonathan struck the Philistines. What takes place today when he engages them, when Jonathan first engages them, that actually takes place in between Michmash and Geba, is where he engages them. So the Philistines have massed at Michmash, and they send out these three companies to kind of wreak havoc in the land. They're right dead center in the middle of the land. They've gone to the heart of the kingdom, right in Saul's neighborhood here, and they intend to squash this immediately. Okay, this move to have a king now, we'll see here in the next set of verses that they had been controlling them economically, and this, you know, was a tolerable situation for the Philistines to let them be. But now that there's been this move with a king, they are moving in to make sure their economic advantage stays. Saul's army at this point is 600 men, which I might just point out is twice as many as Gideon had, okay? And if you might remember, when Gideon went against the Midianites, how many were there? No, when he went against the Midianites, how many Midianites were there? many as the sand is on the seashore. Same description as we have with the Philistines, okay? So just an innumerable amount. I mean, just a massive amount of people. Here we see Saul, he has 600 men, Gideon had 300. Okay, well, let's look at verses 19 through 23. Who would like to read those? Yes, Jeff.
Now there was no blacksmith to be found throughout all the land of Israel. But the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews should be feared. But all the Israelites would go down to the Philistines and sharpen each man's plowshare, his mattock, his axe, and his sickle. The charge for sharpening was of him, the plowshares, and the mattocks, the forks, and the axes, and the sickle. Goes. So it came about on the day of battle. There was neither sword nor spear found in the hand. Any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan were found with Saul and Jonathan's son. The garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass of Michmash.
Okay, thank you. So here we're told that no blacksmith could be found. Okay, could be found in all the land of Israel. That's kind of ambiguous. It's basically stating the fact that they're not there. Okay. But from the Philistine words here, they said, the Philistine said, otherwise the Hebrews will make swords or spears. What does that imply about there being no blacksmiths in Israel? Okay. Yeah, they were tied to it. I mean, this was something that they had brought about. Now, you know, some have suggested that, well, perhaps they had the technology and they just didn't allow it to spread to Israel, or perhaps they had actually removed these individuals. It seems a little interesting that the technology wouldn't be available to them. This technology actually had been around a long time, even when they were back in Egypt. Iron had still been something that they would have learned even back in Egypt. So, again, what exactly was the arrangement here? Had they not allowed it? Had they taken it away? You know, we're not told. It just couldn't be found. And they seemed to have control of the situation. And so they had an active rather than passive role is what's implied here. One thing's for certain, it seems to have been a long-standing reality, okay? It's a long-standing reality. There's no weapons. I mean, iron weapons last a long time. and so this has been a reality for some time. And this created two hardships for Israel. At first, it harmed them economically, okay? If two-thirds of a shekel, if it's referring, I mean, that's just a measurement. It doesn't say a measurement of what. If it was just of silver, it would have been an exorbitant price. So they were using this to their advantage, and that makes sense that they would use it to their advantage. Secondly, it harmed them economically and it harmed them militarily. And that's what's described here. It came about on the day of battle that neither sword nor spear was found in the hand of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan, but they were found with Jonathan and Saul and his son Jonathan. This gives you a little hint here. There's nothing new about gun control, right? I mean, that's essentially what's going on here is, well, we just make sure they don't have the weapons. They're easier to control that way. You can just go into their country and wreak havoc, okay? Nobody can defend themselves. And so, again, there's nothing new under the sun here. And it says, and the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass of Michmash. When it talks about the pass of Michmash, it is referring to this pass that goes from the Jordan Valley, okay, up past Michmash here. There's one that went up to Bethel as well. But the one in view is right here in between Geba and Michmash. And for whatever reason, that you know, there's several towns around here, but it's given the name of the pass of Michmash. And it's just, you know, an easier route, the easiest route to go up from Gilgal into the mountainous region in the center of the country. So that's where all this is taking place, is right in that pass. It's where it takes place initially anyway, when Jonathan engages the armies there. Any questions or thoughts through the end of chapter 13? Okay. Who would like to read chapter 14, verses 1 through 3? Yes, Vince.
Now it happened one day said to the young men, come, let us go over to the Philistine camps that is on the other side. But he did not tell his father. And Saul was sitting in the outskirts of Gibeah under the palm branch tree. Meanwhile, the people who were with him were about 600 men. Aisha, the son of Abital, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, and the host priest in Shiloh, was wearing an ephod. But the people did not know the journey.
Okay. So Jonathan can, I don't want to say consults, he tells his armor bearer, come and let us cross over to the Philistine garrison that is on the other side. So again, we're when he says that, let's go back here. Here he is at Geba, you know, this is the pass right here, and he's saying, let's cross over that. Okay, let's go over. Right now, there's a bit of a natural divide between us, and it's difficult to navigate your armies in between those two towns because of this pass. But he says, you know, let's pass over to their side. Okay, let's make the first move. It says, but he did not tell his father. Why? Okay. Yeah, you're right, because of the vow. But just think about that. What might prompt him? What would prompt any child to hide something from their father?
No.
Okay. Yeah, and when Saul finds out, he's upset. Okay, I mean, he does number the people. He wants to know who did this. Okay. And so at this point, he's taking the initiative. He's just leaving everyone else behind and going ahead. Now, what is Saul doing? Yes. Where at? Yeah, I like pomegranates. I mean, if you had to pick a place to take a siesta, that's a good place to do it. He's under the pomegranate tree. And he's just kind of camped out there, relaxing. I don't know. We're not told, but he's not, you know, the contrast is already starting here. You got Jonathan moving out. In faith, and you have Saul, who's you know, in the hammock by the pomegranate tree. Who is with him? Who's with Saul? Okay, 600 men, and someone else of significance. The priest, Ahijah. And who is Ahijah? Okay, yeah, he's like the grandson or great-grandson of Eli. He'd be the great-grandson of Eli, because he's actually it goes Eli, Phinehas, Ahitub, Ahijah, okay? But interestingly enough, the author feels it important to mention who his uncle is, and his uncle is Ichabod. Why is that significant? Anybody remember what Ichabod's name means? The glory has departed, okay? That was that dark day when Eli and his two sons died. The ark was taken. Now, you got to remember, about 60 years has passed since that event, okay? So Ichabod is you know, older here. He's not still an infant the last time we saw him. But he's not in the direct line. And yet the author feels the need to point that out or draw the attention to that occasion by mentioning his name, okay? And what we see here is that Ahijah, you know, he's not a direct descendant of Ichabod, but he is mentioned, and it caused attention to the fact that Eli's line had been rejected, okay? So what we have is you have Saul, who's just been rejected in verses 1 through 14, and you have Ahijah, whose line had, you know, the line of Eli had been rejected. You have two rejects represented here. Saul and Ahijah, both holding the position, but Ichabod, the glory had departed. Okay, the glory had departed. Samuel was functioning. He was the functional high priest at this time, and Jonathan was the functional king. Here he is. He's the one who's actually engaging the Philistines in battle twice now. Okay, this is the second time. While Saul is not fulfilling his role that he was appointed for. Okay, who would like to read verses 4 through 7? Yes, Jared. Okay, thank you. The pass at Michmash. This is where it is believed this is taking place, right in here. And you can see here, the little W there, it has a name, Sunwenit or whatever. But the W just indicates a wadi. What's a wadi? Does anybody know? It's used occasionally in the Bible. It's a seasonal stream. So sometimes it's dry. It's like a stream up in the mountains. You know, sometimes it's dry. Sometimes there's stream. You know, and when it's rainy season, you'll see water in it. So here it is. This is basically a ravine that runs all the way down to the Jordan Valley, and you could travel up it. And right here is where they believe that Jonathan is crossing over. And this rocky crag right here, they believe that this is the area. Again, you know, there's probably lots of spots it could have been. We're not for sure. But again, you can kind of see what the terrain is like there. Okay, you can see what it is like along that pass there. Jonathan's words, his words tell on him. He says, "Come and let us cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised." He is referring to them as people who are outside the Abrahamic covenant. Okay, the circumcision was a sign of the Abrahamic covenant. These people are outside of God's people, outside of the covenant made with Abraham. And so he is claiming that relationship here. He is, that relationship is important. It's part of how he views everything, that who he is and who they are, and his engaging them. Perhaps the Lord will work for us. What does this indicate about him?
Not a charismatic.
Okay. He's not a charismatic. And what does it say about his character? Well, that's maybe more expressed by the next statement when he says, "Therefore, the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few."
He doesn't know God's will.
Okay, which is humble. Yeah, speaks to his humility. And this is kind of, you know, one of those instances in the scriptures that may be an Old Testament example of what we read in James 4:15. Instead, you ought to say, "If the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil." So he's just being humble about this. It doesn't mean that he doesn't have the faith. Well, maybe God will, maybe he won't. No, faith is humble. And faith says, "Well, I'm stepping out, but God will be God, and he's not subject to me and what I think he should do." But he is stepping out in faith, because the very next thing he says, "For the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few." His actions were prompted by faith in God, not rebellion against his father. Okay? Not rebellion against his father. There's really no other way to read this. He is trusting the Lord here. He's doing exactly what Saul should have done. Again, contrast Saul back in chapter 13, verses 1 through 14, when his army is starting to leave him, okay, the numbers of his army are dwindling, he panics, okay? He panics and transgresses the command of the Lord. Here we see Jonathan saying, "Hey, just the two of us, guess what? The Lord can do this. Doesn't take a big army to do this. It just, you know, the two with faith could do this." As we think about this, contrast between Jonathan and Saul, I made up a slide here. It's kind of interesting what we've seen. We've seen a lot of father sons, haven't we? Just a few, maybe. So I put them up here. Like father, like son? Question mark. Eli and sons, what did we see? We saw a bad father and bad sons. Makes sense, right? Seems logical. We get to Samuel, and we see a good father, confirmed by the Lord, but bad sons. Now we have the reverse. We have Saul and son, Jonathan. We have a bad father and a good son. Okay. And what I ask at the bottom is, what is the formula? There isn't one. Exactly. We're not seeing a pattern here. That the message is that, well, there is none. There is no key. There is no key to success. There is no formula that says X, Y, Z, X plus Y equals Z. And so that's what we see from this passage. This is Deuteronomy 24:16. Fathers shall not be put to death for their sons, nor shall sons be put to death for their fathers. Everyone shall be put to death for his own sin. What does that imply about our own sin? We are responsible for it. No one else is. Okay. And so that same reality is being reflected here, is that ultimately, you know, there is this reality that your sin is your own. And so therefore, you know, the culpability falls to you, not to, again, a bad father, good son. Good father, bad sons. Bad father, bad sons. One does not necessarily lead to the other. Okay. Yes. Okay.
Talks about maybe the Lord will work for us for nothing. Restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. And the cross reference I'm thinking about is in Daniel chapter 3, where Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say to the king, if that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from the hand of the king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, who will not serve your gods. So the reason I bring that up is I think some people think faith is just almost forcing God's hand.
Right.
In both of these cases, they're saying, we believe that God is able, but we're not sure he's going to do it this way, this time.
That's good.
And so I think faith does not necessarily say it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. People make that mistake all the time. They think, if I just have enough faith, it's going to happen.
Right.
Not necessarily. And it doesn't mean you have a lack of faith and you're saying, I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's right. There you go. Yes. Thank you. Thank you for bringing that up. Okay. Anyone else? Yes. Sure.
You can do that, and the child can still go off by the wayside. But it's all you.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and that's, again, you know, you before the Lord. You know, you before the Lord personally, fulfilling your responsibility. Okay. Well, verses 8 through 10, who would like to read those? Yes, Marianne. Thank you. So Jonathan proposes this sign as they're nearing the pass here. They're getting ready to cross over. He proposes a sign. He would reveal himself and wait for a response. Okay? He would wait for a response. And response number one, would be if they said, wait until we come to you. Then we will stand in our place and not go up to them. The present position, especially as we see as we go along a little here, just a few verses later, the present position Jonathan is in when he reveals himself is a position where he is still down. He has to climb up, okay? He has to use all fours to get up to where they're at. And so this indicates that there was still difficult terrain between them. when he would reveal himself, and this sign would be revealed here. When the Philistines, when he revealed himself to the Philistines, you know, if they were to come to him, that was actually a pretty ridiculous notion, because, you know, for them to come down to him, just, again, it wouldn't have been something they would want to do. It would have put them in a very vulnerable position. The sign that he sees is preferable, indicating that, yes, we do want to go up to them, we do want to engage them in battle, is the second response, come up to us. If they say, come up to us, then we will go up, for the Lord has given them into our hands. This is the flip side of this. This shall be the sign, he says. This is the flip side. Now he's putting himself in a vulnerable spot. He is blocking himself in where he's going over the difficult terrain, and it's a whole lot easier to get into that situation than it is to get out, okay? And so he would be in the vulnerable position. Again, I would see this as an indication of his great faith here, choosing the harder position as the appropriate sign. Any questions or thoughts through verse 10? Yes.
You would think that he would, if he lacked faith, he would have said, we're going to come down to you, and they would have turned around and left. But he was like, no, okay, we're going to wait for them. So regardless, he's going to play.
Yeah, I don't see any lack of faith here. Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, verses 11 through 15, who would like to read those? I know it's a few verses. Okay, go ahead. 15.
Then them disclosed themselves under the garrison of the Philistines, and the Philistines said, well, the Hebrews come forth out of hold, themselves. And then the garrison answered, come to us, and you will show yourself. Jonathan sent into his army there, and up after me. The Lord hath delivered them to Israel. Jonathan climbed up.
Okay, thank you. Interesting here. Behold, Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have been hiding themselves. This is most likely they're mocking, okay? They're seeing this, and of course, they knew that they scattered, and they were hiding every nook and cranny in the land. And so they see this. It's most likely a mock. And there were also many Hebrews, as we'll see, that defected to the Philistines as well. They had gone over to their side, and there had been Hebrew battalions or whatever that were functioning under the leadership of the Philistines at this point. And he says, come up, and we will tell you something. it's interesting, and I've read this many times before, but, you know, I've actually experienced that ploy before. You know, come here, I want to tell you something. And when I got over there, it was two older kids. They roughed me up. You know, they slapped me around and all these other things. So it is definitely a ploy that's going on here coming out of their mouth. So they say, come up here and we will tell you something. Of course, they have nothing to tell me. Why don't you tell me from there? Then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet. What does that indicate here? Rough terrain. Yeah, this is definitely he's making himself vulnerable getting up to them. But at the same time, once he gets up there, he's, you know, extremely vulnerable. More than this, the fact that they don't take advantage of the situation, the Philistines don't take advantage of the situation as he's crawling up, what does that indicate about them? Yes, they're presumptuous, okay? This is revealing their own confidence in taking him and his armor bearer. In faith, Jonathan kills about 20 men, it says, in a small area, very short span is described here. And how does God, what does God do in response? He sends an earthquake. Yes, everybody's quaking, all right? Everybody's quaking. And this is ultimately what stirs things up and gets, you know, puts the advantage in Israel's court there. Verses 16 through 19, who would like to read those? Yes, Joy. Yeah, go ahead. That's maybe a euphemism or, you know, an idiom. I mean, basically, he's striking them down. Yeah, he's you know, striking them down. They fell before him in the sense, because it talks about the armor bearer going behind him, putting them to death and so forth. So yeah, that's what's being described there in that idiom. Anyone else? Okay. Who would like to read verses 16 through 19? Janet. Okay. Okay, thank you. What is the result of the earthquake? Okay, yeah. There's utter pandemonium. And what Saul is confronted with now, he has no idea what's going on. Okay, so you might make the case that there's pandemonium going on in the camp of Israel as well, Saul's camp anyway. Why does Saul want to know who is missing? Why might Saul be interested in who is missing? Okay. Yeah, he's a little irritated, perhaps. You know, what is going on here? Who is responsible for this? Who started the battle without me? This is now the second time that Jonathan has done this. Okay, the second time Jonathan has done this. And it says, then Saul said to Ahijah, bring the ark of God here. For the ark of God was at that time with the sons of Israel. Why would he ask for the ark of God to be brought to him? We've seen this before. What's that? Yes, this is the same move that Israel made back when they lost the ark to the Philistines. Never are they instructed to go get the ark and use it in this way, but here he is doing the same exact thing. It echoes again that superstition from earlier. Now, here he is in Gibeah, okay, and here's the ark in Kiriath-Jearim. Now, let's see here. I don't see Michmash on here. There's Geba, so Michmash would be right in about there, okay? Michmash is right by the B on Benjamin there. And so here he is. He's in Geba at this point. Well, no, he's in Gibeah. Jonathan's in Geba. And so Saul's here. He wants to go get the ark over here. Now, how long is that going to take? Yeah, the battle will be over by that time. Go get it, bring it back, then we'll go forward. He ends up abandoning this because it is a ridiculous notion, just practically speaking. You know, it's interesting here. God was already moving through the man of faith, and here's the faithless man, you know, clamoring for, you know, the ark, the rabbit's foot, the good luck charm here. Again, repeating that same mistake made by Israel earlier. Let's see here. Most likely, again, the reason he abandoned this was it represented a major time delay, and he's feeling the pressure again. He doesn't do well when he starts to feel the pressure. While Saul was talking to the priest, it says, the commotion in the camp of the Philistines continued and increased. So it's becoming more intense across the way. So Saul said to the priest, withdraw your hand. Now you wonder, was Saul getting frustrated with Ahijah? Was Ahijah perhaps being a voice of reason here concerning the ark? We don't know. But he gets frustrated with Ahijah. He says, withdraw your hand. That's another way of saying, get away from me. I don't want you here anymore. I don't need you here anymore. I need to get to the battle. The irony of this is that at Gilgal, remember Saul's excuse here? This was just earlier when they were at Gilgal, chapter 13. I have not asked the favor of the Lord, so I forced myself and offered the burnt offering. There, he's making excuses for his sin and not waiting. Okay, and he's like, well, I had to seek the favor of the Lord. At this point, he seems to have abandoned such supposed convictions. And, it's like, let's just forget about the ark. Let's forget about the high priest. Let's just press on and go into battle here. He's vacillating. He doesn't know what to do. He's as frantic as the Philistines, really, at this point. Any questions or thoughts? Right.
I mean, it's like, I think you wanted a quick answer.
Sure.
Probably wasn't coming.
Wasn't coming. Anyone else? Okay. Well, verses 20 through 23, who would like to read those for us? Yes. Okay, thank you. Every man's sword was against his fellow. Now, this has to refer to the Philistines, because remember, Israel didn't have swords at this time. So here we see the Philistines turning on one another. And verse 21, all the Hebrew turncoats that were with the Philistines now turn back to the Hebrews, to Saul's army. And so there begins this attack from those quadrants as well. Verse 22, those that were hiding and fleeing, they come out of the holes and various places that they had hidden, and they are now engaging in the battle as well. So huge turn of events here, which is amazing. It all started with one person. It started with Jonathan saying to his armor bearer, let's go over, see what the Lord does here. Verse 23, the author editorializes this. Now, this is important here. He's giving commentary here in verse 23, and he says, the Lord delivered Israel that day, and the battle spread beyond Beth Aven. And so he's definitely making it clear to us that, hey, the Lord did this. And again, he's doing this in response to Jonathan stepping out in faith. Earlier, we read in chapter 13, verse 5, that Beth Aven, or the Philistines camped at Michmash, east of Beth Aven. So here you have Michmash right here. It was east, okay, Michmash is east of Beth Aven, which puts it somewhere over here. We're not sure where exactly Beth Aven was, but it spread to the west, and they were obviously fleeing back to Philistia at that point. As we see here, just in closing, we have the man of faith versus the man without faith. We got Jonathan whose faith has faith. We got Saul who's faithless. We have Jonathan who has confidence here. He's stepping out. He's doing where Saul is panicked and frantic here, trying to figure out what to do next. We also see with Jonathan his humility, and with Saul, his egocentrism, who did this? just blowing off the priest and so forth. And then we also see here with steady action. Again, this isn't the first time he's engaged the Philistines. This is the consistent pattern of Jonathan here. There's some steady action here from faith where we have inaction and reaction from Saul. Any questions or thoughts there concerning... We'll look at the second half of the battle Saul's foolish vow, which, again, here we see the man of faith, you know, who ends up paying, or almost paying, I should say, for the faithless man's foolishness. Any questions or thoughts? Yes. Well, I think, you know, when they're running and hiding, you know, the classic turncoat, we want to save our own necks. So, yeah, we'll join you in battle. And obviously, the Philistines obviously were overconfident at this point, even in revealed in their response to Jonathan. They obviously thought that they had the day. And this was all about bringing them into subjection again. So it's not like, you know, they're going to kill all the Hebrews here. They just wanted to make sure that the economic arrangement stayed the way it was. So, anyone else? Okay, well, let's go ahead and take some prayer requests then.